The Afterlife podcast employs dark humor and frank language. It is intended for a mature audience. You are listening to Afterlife. I am your host, Maximilian Defoe. Thank you for joining me for episode 11. Popping Bottles. A few women, obviously models, in long bohemian dresses loitered on the front doorstep. Karen wondered if they'd been hired to show up and stand there. A small crowd clustered around two men in golf clothes and seersucker blazers. It was clear that the party guests were expected to enter through the back gate. When Karen and Richard approached, the bouncer noticed Karen and immediately stepped forward to escort them both through the crowd of gatecrashers and into the party. Richard turned to look at Karen in amazement. Karen coped with Richard's thinly veiled indignation by acting aloof. "I'm going to take a look around," Richard informed Karen, as if she hadn't practically begged her to come along. "I'll be here, by the door, ready to leave," Karen said after her, exhaling the last three words under her breath. The backyard was multi-tiered, with various outdoor features on the different levels. At the bottom level, in the center of the space, was a graduated pool. There were clusters of people standing in the shallows. It was all shallows. Karen smiled at the irony. Beyond the pool, straight ahead, was a stage. A man with a wireless microphone paraded himself around it, pumping up the crowd.
"We got a very special guest here. I've been told he's here."
The hype man put his hand up to shield his eyes from the sun as he pretended to search the crowd. While he was unawares, a tall, slender man walked casually up beside him. The crowd, all 600 of them, went ape shit wild. Standing, elegant and commanding, in putty-colored slim-cut silk slacks with carnation pink pinstripes and a powder blue shirt, was Snoop Dogg.
"Oh my God! Oh my God!" The hype man's voice was strained. "I can't believe this!"
he went on, gassing up the crowd, who by Karen's account was already ready to hear the man rap something. Nobody wanted to watch this cheeseball announcer guy mock his own surprise. Unless you're a big star in your own right, thought Karen. To have a star of that magnitude and a DJ at the ready, but to keep everyone waiting instead of handing over the mic, was sadistic. Somebody walked over to the MC and whispered something.
"And we also got..."
And as the MC named off names of other famous people, they migrated to the stage, first shaking hands with the dog father, before finding themselves their own little spot to shine from, either next to someone they seemed to know, or completely away from the others. The DJ teased the crowd with a scratch. The velvety sound of the needle cuts on vinyl hit Karen's pleasure center, releasing a deluge of dopamine lubricating her brain. Like magic, both the DJ and Snoop broke into the first verse of Gin and Juice. Karen couldn't believe she'd almost missed out on this. But then trouble happened. It came in the form of additional microphones. Oh. No, no, no! Some fucking idiot was passing out additional mics. By the time Snoop got into the fourth bar, all the fleas on the big dog's nuts were chiming in. A chorus of hype men. And they didn't stop there. They rapped along with and over Snoop Doggy Dog. Karen wanted to scream. She couldn't even hear Snoop at all. His famous pop star and B-level rapper superfans had been given mics of their own.
and were each giving their own concert, excitedly rapping every line of not only the chorus, but every line of every verse. So great was their alacrity, the vainglorious clowns drowned out the sound of history happening. The arrogance was unreal. Karen wished that she could transform herself into a flying dragon and breathe fire at all of them, leaving just their charred remains and Snoop to perform his own songs without the distraction of the strained, unrehearsed voices, hoarse and phlegmy from cigar smoke and menthol cigarettes, not spinning fire, but regurgitating lyrics, loud but uncertain, inarticulate and slurred from too much Hennessy. Damn them, messing up her and Snoop's moment. God damn these spotlight-thirsty people, desperate for attention beyond what they deserved, before it was warranted, and where it hadn't been earned, wanting everyone's attention on themselves when it was clearly another person's moment to shine. The person who'd originated the shit, perfected a hit, and rehearsed it. Standing center stage was the man who'd done all that. The genuine article, literally obscured by poor imitations. Karen, disgusted, looked around. This party wasn't her scene. And this was what Karen had suspected of Saatchi's camp. It was the reason she hadn't come around to introduce herself or make attempts to be neighborly, and why she hadn't been impressed by his supposedly brilliant brand of creativity. There was an undefined lack of artistic etiquette, a nebulous lack of respect for the craft of music itself. It showed up in the lyrics, in the performance of the music, and their public kerfuffles with other artists. People, it seemed to Karen, that they'd have done better to find a way to get along with. Self-adulation was king, glaring like a dark birthmark on the precious face of hip-hop was a petulant lack of not only racial, but social, cultural, and even familial solidarity. Entitlement issues, abandonment issues, homophobia, misplaced aggression, petty jealousies, all could be heard in rhyming couplets, if one was listening. Separatist rantings. Karen felt cheated about not having been wrong about Saatchi and his garden parties. This was one time it would have been great to discover that she had been wrong in harboring some unexplored prejudice. Oh well. As if the universe understood Karen's intention, Richard appeared through the crowd. "He's not here anymore," she said, still looking around furtively. "I'm leaving," Karen said dryly. Karen sulked gloomily down the drive, still miffed about the botched impromptu Snoop Doggy Dog concert. She shoved her hands down into her pockets. To walk down the street, she'd taken off her cocktail gown and put on a belted shorts jumper in black silk and some black, low-slung, matte satin heels. When Richard and Karen reached the sidewalk in front of Karen's house, Richard slowed down a bit, but Karen kept walking.
"You live here. Where are you going?" demanded Richard.
"I know where I live. Why are you still hounding me? Get lost."
"Well, you don't have to be so rude," said Richard, a matter-of-factly.
"That's the way you like it," Karen didn't say. She turned into the pedestrian walkway of an open drive.
"Do you know those people?"
Richard sounded genuinely curious. Karen turned her back on Richard without bothering to answer. She was tired of pretending. It was obvious these people were having an open house. It seemed to Karen a good time for her to drop by and introduce herself. She considered going home to fetch a bottle of wine to bring. It wasn't Karen's style to show up empty-handed if she were going to be an actual guest, but it wouldn't hurt to take a quick peek around. If it was cool, maybe she'd pop back by with a bottle of wine. Karen ducked inside.
"Well, I want to come," Richard said, applying too much shiny lip gloss as she stalked along, engrossed in the study of her own image projected back at her through her iPhone camera. Karen was sure she'd been taking selfies on the way.
She groaned inaudibly and moved into the crowd.
Most of the people looked older than Karen by a mean of about 10 years. A woman in a chef's hat came around offering people something on her tray. When she came to Karen, she had only 2 left. Smoked salmon canapés. The foundation of the little food stack was a wafer of puffed rice with a dollop of creme fraiche. The bouncy little orange cube of smoked lox had a garnish of chives, chopped fine, and a dusting of fresh dill. Karen took them both, putting the second one directly into her mouth. She rolled her eyes in ecstasy. A butler approached, presenting a cocktail tray with flutes of champagne and short glasses of scotch on offer. Karen took one of each and looked for a place to sit down. Several domestic servants in uniforms patrolled the outskirts of the room, making subtle passes into the standing groups of people to offer drinks and hors d'oeuvres or clear away a neglected drink. Across the room, Richard flipped her hair around for an oafish older man, fiendishly hovering in the airspace above Richard's messy titties. He gazed into her eyes with the lasciviousness of a nursing child. From the looks of things, Richard may have found herself another trick. Also across the room, sitting alone on a divan, was another middle-aged man, a face Karen hadn't expected to see. She'd been avoiding him, actually. Even though they had never met, it didn't matter. Karen instantly recognized his face. From the Registered Sex Offenders Database. Running high emotions after watching The Woodsman, Karen had looked up her own address to see how many registered sex offenders were living in her own neighborhood. She'd accessed the database via a portal from a website educating citizens on Megan's Law. When the map of her area popped up, a legend on the sidebar explained that the small blue squares were the locations of registered offenders, and that the larger blue squares indicated one location where several offenders were located. Karen had imagined an apartment building, something like the one on a popular nighttime drama in the late 90s called Melrose Place. A small two-story building with the front doors to each of the apartments facing an enclosed courtyard. In Karen's fantasy, each of the residents, instead of being talent agents and models like the characters on the show, were workaday sex offenders. Karen wondered about the effect being a registered sex offender had on someone's personal life. Had any of them looked themselves up just to see what information would come up, or more to the point, to see the mugshot on display for anyone in the world to see? And what if they had looked at the site, punched in their own zip code, just as Karen had, and discovered that there was another few registered sex offenders in their own apartment building? Would they go out of their way to meet each other?
Hi, I'm Reginald from 203. My internet isn't working. Are you having the same problem?
Hey. What are you up to later? Want to hang out? And what if one or both of them knew of their shared identity? Would they discuss it? Only one small blue square had popped up on the interactive map of Karen's vicinity. The site had warned it would reveal real names, actual addresses, and details of the offense. Before she was allowed to access the database, she'd been forced to either select a box that said she understood or exit the system. In addition to the already dark nature of the site, the warning and request for compliance seemed threatening. There was even a part about not using the information for anything other than protecting her family. Karen didn't have any children, but she didn't feel it was fair to only protect the young and innocent. Karen herself was neither. But she felt she was just as deserving of safety walking the streets. She'd personally never had any issues before, but the woman who worked as a manager at a boutique clothing shop across from her favorite French fry spot liked to jog around Silver Lake Reservoir, and she had. As the woman had told it,
She was jogging on her own in the middle of the day, and a man who looked about 50 had pulled down his sweatpants and shaken his flaccid penis at her as he'd leaped out into her path from where he'd been hiding behind a tree. Karen hadn't meant to be insensitive, but couldn't hold back her laughter. The last time Karen had seen her retail buddy, she'd confided she'd been abstaining from sex to recover from a recent breakup, but was finally ready to pick up and carry on. She was ready to get laid, but that had been weeks ago, and as the manager had reported to Karen before she'd launched into the flaccid penis shaker story with the bluster of a hangry pirate, she'd gone out on a few dates, but still hadn't gotten any yet. And now, here were men, literally, jumping out before her, taunting her with the elusive meat. The shop manager hadn't been mad that Karen had laughed. She gave a good-natured hearty-har herself that Karen had found her story so funny, but her amusement ended there. After Karen collected herself, the woman told her that three women in the area in the past 6 months had been harassed, and that in one case, the offender, a male posing as a jogger, attacked a woman, ostensibly with intent to rape. That made Karen stop laughing. Unfortunately for the man, his intended victim was a rape survivor. She'd beat the man senseless, then left him unconscious and hanging by a thread to his life for the cops to pick up. When the incident happened, the neighborhood newspaper had run a story on it. But of course they'd left out all the juicy parts, saying only that the police have arrested a man accused of attacking female joggers, and that the arrest was made following a local woman's response to a public appeal for information leading to the identity of a known criminal. Hardly at all what happened. The manager knew the real story because she knew the hero woman personally, had been the one to pour her a shot of something stiff and do some preliminary bandaging of the survivor's busted knuckles immediately after it happened. Since that story ran in the paper, the manager had not just that one man, the flaccid penis shaker, but two others exposed themselves to her as she walked or jogged on the street, as if the public shaming of one offender enticed others out who were also hoping to be arrested. Karen thought the woman was making an ironic joke at first, but she wasn't. "There are rapists all around," the manager had warned Karen, and then she told Karen about the registered sex offenders database. But by the time she arrived home that day, Karen had forgotten the whole shebang. Until the Woodsman movie and Megan's Law, Karen hadn't thought once about the For Her Safety database. When she'd clicked the square, a pop-up window appeared with the first and last name, a residential address, and a headshot photograph of the person's face. She'd committed that face to memory, so that if she ever saw it out anyplace, she'd know to go the other way. And here it was across the room. He was well-dressed and looked friendly. To someone looking for a place to sit, next to him looked like a good place. You've been listening to the Afterlife Podcast. Thank you for joining me for episode 11, Popping Bottles. The Afterlife Podcast is serialized paranormal fiction based on the book Afterlife, written by me, Maximilian Defoe, available on Amazon next week on the Afterlife Podcast. Karen learns an important lesson about power, what it looks like to be truly great, and a ghost of Hanukkah past appears at Cassandra's cocktail party to harass the ghost of Jimmy Jennings. For more episodes of the Afterlife Podcast, visit TarynMaximilianDefoe.com. Forever Afterlife. That's forever dash afterlife. It just doesn't sound as cool when I say dash, so I just, okay, but you know what it is. Where you can find not only episodes that you may have missed, but links to the Afterlife boards on Pinterest featuring additional material, videos and images of Karen's bachelorette pad, what's inside Cassandra's closet. She's got some sexy, naughty stuff in there, and some scrumptious salmon canapé recipes, and other goodies revolving around Cassandra's party on the butler's tray. I'm serious about the recipes, by the way. Did you like this episode? Yes? Yes! Leave me a review on iTunes. It really does make a difference. Tap your hot little finger on the link to my blog in the description of this podcast to see how and why. Links to every place you can find me in the description of this episode. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening.